You are listening to Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Greetings, everyone. My name is Marty Leeds, and I am your host. Thanks so much for joining me. This show is dedicated to the open exploration of all subjects ranging from spirituality to science. The focus is to highlight the movers and shakers of our day, authors, researchers, and artists. This show provides an open platform to allow guests to discuss their work and findings. This show will also be promoting original independent musicians, singer-songwriters, and bands to give them a chance to have their music heard by a wider audience. Tonight's guests are Scott Onstott from secretsinplainsight.com, and our musical guest will be Sioux City, Iowa's own Elsa Vaugh. This show is brought to you by The Sync Book Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Middle Chamber, and Synchronize. More information about Sync Book Press, Sync Book Radio, or Sync Book events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support. Our guest tonight is Scott Onstott. Scott Onstott is the creator of the Secrets in Plain Sight video series and author of the books Quantification, Taking Measure, and contributor to The Sync Book 2. In the last dozen years or so, he has written 11 books and produced 16 video training products on computer-aided design and 3D visualization software. Scott has a degree in architecture and worked in several architecture and engineering offices in his early career. He has also taught 38 semester-length courses at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco, and his websites include scottonstott.com and secretsinplainsight.com. Scott uploaded Secrets in Plain Sight in October 2010, and since then, Volume 1 has over 3 million views on YouTube. Our discussion today will be focusing on Scott's new book, Quantification, as well as Taking Measure, his first book on sacred geometry, as well as his videos, Secrets in Plain Sight 1 and 2. So without further ado, let's get pious with Scott Onstott. Scott, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me. I really look forward to delving into your work, and I always look forward to our conversations.
Thanks a lot for having me on the show.
Yeah, this is my flagship episode, so we're going to see how this goes, so you'll just have to bear with me a little bit here, but no, I really appreciate you being on the show. You know, this show is dedicated to exploring all sorts of different things, whether it's like mathematics or geometry or mythology or spiritual concepts or science, and to have you as the first guest on the show is pretty serendipitous, I guess I want to say, is pretty important because you and I, we've been friends for quite a while. I think I first spoke with you in 2011, and you ended up editing my first book, and so I've known you for a while, and we've had a back and forth via, you know, email and Facebook and all that. So, yeah, it's just great that you're on the show. So I do a little introduction before the show, but I kind of want people to hear it from the horse's mouth, if you will. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what it is you do and, you know, where people can find you on the net and that sort of thing?
Oh, sure, yeah. So I have a degree in architecture. I worked in the architectural field for 6 or 7 years before starting to teach people about architectural software. And I did that for a number of years in San Francisco, and then eventually I started writing books on architectural software. And then it wasn't until I moved to a remote island in British Columbia that I started researching some of these esoteric subjects that are very interesting. And that eventually led to me creating Secrets in Plain Sight, the video series. And it also led to me writing a couple of books. One's called Taking Measure, and the most recent book is called Quantification. And those are explorations of primarily of number of and sacred geometry in the world. I look at significant buildings, temples. I look at patterns in the world, in the cosmos, and I make some quantification is all about illustrations that illustrate these concepts, and taking measure goes into greater depth, and it's all kind of interrelated to Secrets in Plain Sight in the video series that I've made. I've made volumes 1 and 2, and those are available at secretsinplainsight.com.
Great, yeah, cool.
You know, so you've been in the architectural, you know, that sort of realm for a long time, obviously dealing with math and geometry for quite some time. But what particularly got you into sacred geometry and studying like the esoteric aspects of this? Was there anything, any particular book, or was it just kind of years of studying these things that kind of led you into it?
Well, I guess there are certain milestones that I look back and recognize that were kind of important. Just studying architecture is one way into learning about geometry. But I think I heard the term sacred geometry when I was in university, but I didn't really know what it meant. And it wasn't until I moved to where I live now that I read, this was about 10 or 11 years ago, I read The Ancient Secret of the Flower of Life by Drenvalo Melchizedek. And he has some really far out there ideas, but he has some really excellent sacred geometry also. And that kind of got me interested in the subject. And then I had studied crop circles in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I would, as a hobby, I would kind of just draw them in the computer. And if I could figure out the geometry behind the design. And those, especially studying crop circles, really kind of opened my mind to the beauty of sacred geometry. And I think that really laid the groundwork for me later reading a lot of books about esoteric subjects, that just one thing led to another. And eventually, I just started perceiving the patterns in the world. And at a certain point, around 2009, I realized I should make a video, and I actually talked to an intuitive about that, and she directed me to, I was going to make a video, and it's just what I did. But it's a continuing journey. You know, I'm still finding things out. You know, sometimes I think they're really profound discoveries. Like just the other day, I thought to measure the distance from the Cleopatra's Needle, it's an ancient Egyptian obelisk in London, to the location where it used to be in Alexandria, Egypt. And it just turns out that that's 3,333.3 kilometers from where it was until where it is. And I think, you know, we can talk about the significance of repetitive digits, perhaps.
Let's get into that. Actually, a little bit later in the hour, if you don't mind. I wouldn't mind covering a little bit of groundwork here first.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, you find a lot of these repetitive digits, and obviously through your own exploration, you keep finding these again and again and again. And there seems to be something that, as you were saying, that there are these patterns within the number and the geometry itself, and then, of course, even where things like Cleopatra's Needle is, and, of course, your work is focused on, hey, how far is away this pyramid to this state building or this temple or this cathedral, and you really elucidate the fact that there are these repeating patterns of numbers that come up again and again and again. What is that, personally, what does that mean to you? Like, I guess the question is, what does sacred geometry mean to you? Obviously, the word sacred is dealing with, you know, divinity or, you know, the universality or God, that sort of thing. But in a general sense, what does sacred geometry mean to you? What does it mean to you when you find these number patterns coming up again and again?
Well, I guess it's kind of a journey that I've gone on where I started to realize that geometry underlies everything. And that's both in terms of triangles and squares and what we normally think of as geometry, as well as the literal meaning of the word, which is earth measure. And so just by going out and measuring and weighing and dividing, they're sort of like the keys to the universe are out there waiting to be found. And at least in my journey, I've discovered that everything seems to be built on number. It's like the bedrock of everything. And
this has been echoed by many, many great, theologians and philosophers and, you know, magicians all throughout time as well, correct?
That's right. And in fact, in the medieval liberal arts, they talk about the quadrivium, which is number, geometry, music, and astronomy. And an elegant way of explaining why those subjects were chosen is because the most fundamental of all arts and sciences is number theory, and then number in time is music, number in space is geometry, and number in time and space is really the manifest universe, and one way of looking at that is with astronomy. You can also extend that down to our terrestrial sphere by measuring the Earth and looking at distances on the Earth and so on. But, go ahead.
If I may, so the geometry in and of itself, when we talk about geometry, we talk about Earth measure. And so, if I'm getting you right, basically, by measuring the Earth and understanding that there's an inherent or an innate number pattern within it also allows us to understand, if we understand the Earth, that allows us to understand the heavens, correct? Is that kind of the idea?
That's right. And there's this age-old saying, as above, so below. And these patterns exist at all scales. And so you can look up in the cosmos and find a Vesica Pisces in the in a nebula. Or, you can look at the paths around the Washington Monument as another example of a Vesica Pisces symbol. Or you can look at the cover of Chalice Well in Glastonbury, and there's another one. So there's a Vesica Pisces to be found in the biology of the cell or deeper in the atomic world. Because geometry is really the fundamental matrix that we're in, if you will, it makes sense that you see an expression of geometry at all scales. And an example of that on a macro scale is the hexagon on the North Pole of Saturn. That's an incredible pure geometry. That hexagon is actually quite a bit larger than the Earth. And we can look all the way down to the reflection in the eye of a dragonfly, and you can find the same hexagon pattern emerging there because of the compound eye and the way that it's structured. It's made up of all these triangles, and you see that same pattern emerge, many orders of magnitude smaller.
And so really kind of like number and geometry allows us to elucidate the fundamental patterns or archetypal patterns within in creation as you were saying, like a scale invariance. It really doesn't matter what scale we look at, whether it's the sixth planet from the sun being Saturn, or if we look at the eye of a dragonfly, we're going to find these same patterns. And therefore, that's why it's kind of deemed sacred, correct?
That's exactly right. It's getting, realizing the beauty of it and that it's holy, it's sacred, it's awe-inspiring, it's mind-blowing, we could call it mind-blowing geometry instead of sacred geometry.
It just doesn't have the same ring, right?
Yeah, we're just going to go with the traditional sacred geometry.
It's cool because you just mentioned the matrix and the kind of that we live in a matrix, almost that this is, we could almost say like an illusion or a hologram or something like that. And in the beginning of your book, your new book, Quantification, you even start out saying, enter the matrix, as if, welcome to understanding that this world is almost crafted by numbers and geometry, and that you can understand the matrix that we're kind of been given in a way. At least that's what I got from reading beginning your book. Let's talk about quantification a little bit. I want to talk about some specifics in the book. I got a chance to preview it, and it's just a fantastic book. I really, really enjoyed it. First off, the thing that really caught my attention, I don't have the physical copy of the book, but you sent this to me over via email, is that let's talk about the dimensions of the book itself. So for people that are listening, take note, because, by encoding dimensions into the book as you have, you are almost in and of itself unveiling secrets in plain sight. You're occulting or encoding these key numbers or canonical numbers into the actual geometry of your book. Can you talk a little bit about the size of the book and the importance of the numbers that you chose and et cetera?
Hopefully I can remember exactly what that comparison was, but I think it had to do with the area of the page. That's it. So the first of all, one of the major themes in quantification is my analysis of the Great Pyramid. And its slope angle is 51.85 degrees. And I chose to publish this book with a square aspect ratio because that was the, it just seems best suited to illustrations. They didn't offer landscape orientation at the publisher. So everything else was portrait. And I thought square was going to be the best choice. And it just so happens that it's 8.5 inches by 8.5 inches, or slightly less. And when you multiply 8.5 times 8.5, you get 72 square inches. And it just so happens that there are 72 pages in the book, if you include, you know, the introduction and the end notes and everything. And 72 times 72 is 5184. So there you go. Those are the numbers representing the slope of the Great Pyramid. 51.84 or 51.85 degrees, very close to the slope of the Great Pyramid. And that was totally accidental.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was just going to ask.
Yeah, so I didn't plan that. But I right after I published it, I just had a feeling that I should calculate the total area of all the pages for some reason. And then there you go. There's another encoding there. And I think oftentimes that's how the encodings happen. You're not aware of them when you're doing them. But then later you may or may not notice that what you've done has just encoded this amazing resonance. Like Cleopatra's Needle, I don't really think that anyone measured that distance and planned it. It just so happens that it was exactly 3,333.33 kilometers from where it was in Alexandria to where it is now. But what's happening is there's a deeper planning going on. And I show a lot of these types of things, like the distance from the Ishtar Gate where it was in Babylon to where it is now in Berlin is 3,333 kilometers. And again, I don't think that was planned. It just, what I mean is it wasn't planned by the archaeologist who found it or the people that located Berlin exactly where it is. I think that's really preposterous to think that London was located where it is so that it could make this encoding, or Berlin was put exactly where it is. But nevertheless, it gives you a deeper understanding of reality, that there is a plan, there is a deeper resonance there. And I really don't usually talk about why that is. I just leave that open for the listener. About if you think that that's God that's doing that, that's one way of looking at it. If you think it's a conspiracy or aliens behind it or spirits or awareness, those are all possibilities.
If I may ask, I mean, what's your take on this? I mean, what's your personal opinion on when you continue to find these things? I mean, what does it mean to you?
Well, my personal opinion is that the universe and everything in it, including Scott and Marty, are a work of the imagination. And that, you know, you are the creator, actually. And you're just living in this illusion that you're this this person called Marty Leeds. You know, and that's actually another level of an illusion, because I know that's also not really your name. But you know, in a way, everything is a fiction, is a work of imagination, and we have this unlimited capacity to imagine, and the way that we've imagined everything is using number at the foundation, and so there are opportunities that we have to express that and to reveal that the numerical basis of reality. And once in a while, we kind of do that. And I kind of think of it like a bit like an Easter egg or a gift to those that are ready to perceive that. There are signs.
I think that's a great way to put it. Is that this is kind of an imagination by a creator, and you being part of that imagination. I actually just posted this on Facebook the other day, and it's from the Dimensions of Paradise, John Michel, which I know you've read. It's just a fantastic book. But apropos to what you were saying, there's a quote here. It says, "In the writings of the old philosophers, there is a common agreement that the true purpose of number is for investigating the universe. Traditional cosmogonies tell how the creator dreamed up a scheme of number. And from that original thought, everything else proceeded." And I think that's just kind of in tune with what you're saying, was that that there seems to be an intelligent force that's kind of imagining this or dreaming this up, and it's using this playful number and geometry in sort of this playful, artistic and imaginative way. And this is kind of what we see. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Exactly. And there are philosophers who have seen this before. And there are great quotes like that are to be found. And, Pythagoras said, "All is number." And, he meant it. But we mostly think of that as a kind of mysticism today, and we don't really take it seriously. But what I'm trying to show in my work is that it's these are facts. These are distance measurements or alignments, and they are really there. And whether you want to perceive that or not is up to you. But if you want to see the patterns, they're secrets in plain sight. They're right there.
Yeah, the door is open for
the door is open. Yeah, exactly. But I think that also the patterns usually are, let's say, a tenth of a percent off. There's always a small variance. And it's really, really tiny like that. But I think that's done to give you a way out. So you can say, all right, that's really interesting, but it's just, this guy's crazy, or it's just not there. Because, a lot of people aren't quite ready or not interested in perceiving these patterns, and that's their right. That's completely fine. So I think that's probably why there are these. It comes across more as a work of art than a cold hard science.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, especially when you bring up like Pythagoras, or the same thing goes with like Isaac Newton. I mean, these guys were mystics. They were, in all sense of the terms, at the very definition of the word, they were mystics, And I think that a lot of modern theory, a lot of people that have this very Cartesian or mechanistic approach to understanding the world, they kind of deny that stuff. And I think that a lot of the things that you're bringing out as far as the mathematics are concerned is that there is this sort of, in one section of the book, you talk about math games, about playing around with number to like reveal patterns and interesting connections and things like that. And the thing I always want to get to is that there's obviously, if we have this very creative and playful and synchronistic side of the math that we can show very clearly and that you're bringing to the forefront. And to me, it seems like that proves that there's much more going on with number and geometry than modern science is understanding. And so when they go to try to understand, deconstruct the world mechanistically, it's almost like they're missing the boat, or they're not playing with a full deck, if you will. And I know that this idea goes into numerology, it goes into number symbolism, it goes into sacred geometry. How do you feel about this approach to math, our modern approach to math? Do you feel like that they're missing the boat, I guess is the question?
Well, I think modern science is very useful and wonderful in its own way. But essentially, yes, the dominant paradigm in science is that that matter is something outside of you that's separate from you, that is real, and that there's a substance there. But unfortunately, like, scientists don't really take the quantum physics really seriously, because when they really look into matter, they find that it's like 99.999999999% nothing. And, you know, there's really nothing there.
So how are you going to quantify that, right?
Yeah. And so it's also looking at everything in a kind of dead way, where it's all inert matter. It's all there's no consciousness to it. It's just that stuff, that dirt. But really, if you kind of flip it all around and look at that actually everything in the universe might be part of you, part of your imagination. It's all alive. It's as alive as you are. So it's a totally different way of looking at the world and appreciating it than we're led to think in traditional science.
Why do you think that there's such a rejection to all of these? I mean, really, a lot of the things that you're exploring kind of cracks open the door to understanding deeper aspects of religion, mythology, sacred sciences, and things like that. Why do you think that there's such a rejection to this with modern scientists? I mean, why there seems to be this movement of trying to almost like bury the past, of trying to like put away, okay, we're done with religion now. That's caused us enough harm. Let's move on. I mean, why do you think this is?
Well, I think it has to do with the birth of science in that it was a reaction against religion. And that was very important for us as humans to make that break away from superstition and to develop the rational capacity. And so I think that was really essential in our development. But breaking away from spirit, from looking at anything that isn't physical and pretending it's not there, is a problem ultimately, because you're ignoring huge amounts of phenomena in the world. Like,
Essentially
for
everything, right? I mean, if
like
an atom
well,
is 99 point,
yeah,
I
and
mean.
it's like physicists, they say there's like the universe is got 96% dark matter and dark energy. And they just came up with those terms because they figured out, okay, we don't really know what that stuff is, so we'll call it dark matter and dark energy. And then they calculated that that actually adds up to something like 96% of everything. So really, physics is just the understanding of 4% of reality. It's really useful and practical, but it's kind of limiting in a way. You know, it's like it's wonderful to have that focus, but I think it's also important to widen your focus and widen your field. And when you see patterns emerge, not to ignore them and pretend they're just coincidence. You know? Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things that really drew me to your work is that there's, it's like you deal directly with hard scientific empirical facts. I mean, we're talking about measurement here, but at the same time, you're willing to bend and stretch that and look beyond, look beyond the square, if you will. And so that's what I find that is really great about your work. And by doing this, it seems like you've really unveiled a whole lot of really great, really, wonderful information. Obviously, most people that go to, I don't want to generalize here, but a lot of people that end up going to college and going through a lot of the courses that you have probably gone through, whether just like the mathematics courses and the architectural courses and things like that, tend to be only on, it will say, the left brain side, that very like analytical, linear, quantitative side. What drew you to the qualitative and the esoteric side and things like that? Like, what, I guess the question is, what has been your spiritual ascent, if you will, or what's been your spiritual quest? Did you grow up going to church? Was the religious, spiritual things, was this thrusted on you at some point in your life? What's your journey there?
Okay, well, in my, adolescent years, I was brought up Christian, and eventually around puberty, I started to have the capacity for rational thinking. I've always been kind of prone to rational thinking, developing the left brain. And the religious explanations were unsatisfying to me personally at a certain stage in my life. And especially when I went to university, that was really quite a lot of development of the left brain in the first couple of years because I was studying engineering. And then I changed my major in my junior year to architecture. And architecture requires that you learn how to draw and express yourself with your right brain also. And so that was very challenging, but also very beneficial to have a little bit more balance there compared to just the more analytical side. And so I had, both hemispheres, kind of an opportunity for them to work together a little more, I guess. And that helped me out.
But mainly this was just kind of a personal journey. This was no one kind of led you. You didn't have a yogi or Yoshi or anything like that. This was just you.
No. I haven't followed any particular spiritual teachers or pathways like that, other than just the sort of cultural inheritance I got growing up in a kind of Christian culture / atheist culture. So that's one way to look at it. But I'm really interested in all the religions and all the sacred traditions because I think they ultimately are getting at the same source. And there are many different ways of going about that. I think if you believe in reincarnation, which I do, I think I had past lives in different cultures and different religions. And so, I see more of the unity of mankind rather than the one way is right and everybody else is wrong kind of way.
You know, it's cool that you bring up, the fact of kind of like comparative mythology and the unity of all of these different spiritualities. And then, I find it very refreshing and very respectful that you didn't follow any particular path, that you kind of, went into this stuff on your own with an open mind and then have made the discoveries that you've made. Well, I kind of want to talk about something particular about the math of and looking at these comparative, all of these different cultures and then finding the same things that come up. And this is something that I think you talk about it in your new book, and you also talk about it in Secrets in Plain Sight. And this is the star octagram. Do you want to talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, it's a solar symbol seen in cultures all around the world in different contexts. Off the top of my head, I can remember the star of Inanna, the star of Lakshmi.
Actually, I have your quote here. Yeah, you have the Buddhist wheel of Dharma, the Christ Pantocrator, the Dendera zodiac. So yeah, a lot of references to this in multi cultures, the same exact symbol.
There's about a dozen of them, I think, that I've found, or many other people have noticed as well. But it's it ends up being also a calendar, like the pagan calendar or Celtic calendar resonates with that, and it's kind of a solar representing the our path around the sun. Why do you bring that up? Are you curious about that particular symbol?
Well, yeah, I just found it interesting that, when you were looking at all of, obviously that you were interested in all the different world religions, and then your focus was on geometry and mathematics, that you, by focusing on geometry and mathematics, that you were allowed to make these correlations, like, hey, we find this symbol here, we find it in Buddhism, we find it in, so I just find that really interesting, that we have, almost as if number and geometry gives us, as you were saying before, is almost like this key to understand the matrix of our reality, and that this is what all of these different cultures ended up finding and using the same symbol. So I think it's almost like by focusing on something like the star octagram allows us to really crack open the mysteries and allow us to see all of the all the connectivity between all of these different seemingly separate or disparate belief systems.
Yeah, and geometry is universal. It's not like you have a Christian geometry and an Islamic geometry and a Hindu geometry. They're all the same geometry, and also the numbers are the same, aren't they? It's sort of a universal universal language, and that could be the way that something that we all have in common, for sure, is sacred geometry.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, like the 3, 4, 5 Pythagorean triangle is the same. It doesn't matter if you're a Hindu or you're a Mayan or you're, you know, et cetera, obviously. So that's really kind of this unifying force. That's what you found, right?
Exactly. And I think something like the Great Pyramid has this geometry to it that holds all these amazing keys and so-called secrets in plain sight just in its very geometry. And that can be decoded by anyone who, and you can speak any language, it doesn't matter. It's something that's beyond language. It's beyond arbitrary interpretation. It's getting down to something more fundamental.
I talk a lot about the Great Pyramid of Giza, and I know you highlight it a lot in your new book. I think there's something that people should know that is pretty important is that when we talk about the Great Pyramid of Giza, really what we're talking about at the core, when you at least look at it in two dimensions, is squaring the circle. And this is basically what the Egyptians understood or discovered or was passed on to them. And so a lot of times I think that we look at the Great Pyramid of Giza and we don't realize that we're really dealing with one of these fundamentals of geometry. Do you want to talk about squaring the circle at all?
Sure. You can actually also look at it in three dimensions. The three-dimensional form squares the circle. The base perimeter is equal to the circumference of a circle whose radius is equal to the height of the pyramid. So one of my images in quantification on page 29 is called Squaring the Circle, and it shows that I have a 3D model of the pyramid with a circle there. And it essentially makes that connection. And the square is always, it sort of represents the terrestrial world, the rational, measurable, orthogonal kind of measuring plots of land kind of thing. And the circle is representing the heaven because it's an infinity of points that are equidistant from a center. And so when we square the circle, we are bringing heaven down to earth, or earth up to heaven, if you will. We're bridging that gap. And so it's kind of a beautiful action. But, mathematicians have proven that it's impossible because of the transcendental nature of pi. You can never do it absolutely exactly. But that's in a Euclidean space, which is this void. If you were to put it on the surface of a curved surface such as the Earth, it's entirely possible. And it's also practical in that in the real world, you can square the circle. There's no material that you have that's absolutely perfect down to a single atom. You're going to get close for all practical purposes. And essentially, that's what the Great Pyramid does. It squares the circle.
And this idea that you can't, that we can't find the area of a circle because of the transcendental nature of pi, really kind of gets to this idea of the real and the ideal. Almost that, like, sacred geometers of old were always trying to get as close to the ideal as possible, but of course, we can never really get that. And this kind of goes to that whole idea of square and circle, heaven and earth, that's been a consistent theme throughout sacred geometry, sacred geometrical canon for a long time.
That's right.
And you actually talk about the difference of, or the relationship that the cube and the sphere have with one another and phi. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I kind of stumbled across this relationship that, squaring the circle is something that people have been trying to do for ages. And I thought, well, why don't we try to cube the sphere and take it up a dimension. And I discovered that if you draw a golden rectangle, that is a rectangle that has a length of 1 to 1.618, with that proportion, that's the key that allows you to cube the sphere. And I have an illustration that shows that on page 3. And it's kind of hard to explain without you know, the picture is really worth like 10,000 words.
It really is, because when you see it, it's really, well, the first time I saw it too, my jaw just kind of dropped. I was like, oh, it's just, there's just a beauty to it, really.
Yeah, yeah. So it's all based on the golden rectangle, and it's 99% accurate. So again, it's not, a mathematician could prove that it's not, you know, not exact. And the problem that we have with science is that when someone says, well, it's not absolutely perfect, well, then are we, you know, is your response to be to completely ignore it, or to take it for what it's worth, that there's this amazing parallel there that's 99% accurate? It's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's almost like, you know, if somebody, you know, if I said, hey, you know, if I gave you $999,999.99 and I gave you a million, would you be cool with that? You know, most people would say yes, right?
Yeah,
but when it comes to hard science, no, yeah. No, you didn't give me a million. And so there's,
yeah.
And there is this margin of error in all sciences. So I guess I don't understand why that's such a problem, an inherent problem with so many people.
Well, it's a problem with the left brain, I think.
Yeah.
It's dissatisfied when it doesn't have everything in its proper place. And it has a trouble with that.
Yeah, almost like it's like
just our nature.
Yeah, almost like the square and circle as well. It's like if you have the, you know, four 90-degree corners, that's a square, and you say 360 degrees, everything's fine. But when you bring it into a circle and you can't find that area, if you will, then there's a problem. There's the kind of left-right brain approach, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Sort of like the frustration with irrational numbers. I think there's a story about how Pythagoras threw somebody overboard when he reveal, you know, the square root of 2, how it's not rational. It's irrational. It drove him crazy.
Yeah. It's so funny, you hear all these old stories about Pythagoras, about how, yeah, I had heard another one where it's like somebody brought up a fraction and he shot him, or, you know, he killed him, and he didn't shoot him, but, you know, he killed him. It's,
yeah,
like, you wonder, like, where do these stories come from? You know, is this these just old wives' tales that have been created over time to kind of, like, you know, to you know, draw people away from the work of Pythagoras or something, kind of getting a little conspiratorial there. But, you know, you always wonder where these things come from, you know, and how much validity there is to them.
Well, I think it might have been valid that, you know, irrational numbers were really tricky for people for a while. And then later, the square root of -1 was considered just a totally crazy idea. You know, nobody wanted to go near that one. Until mathematicians said, well, what if we just pretended that the square root of -1 was, we'll call it I, okay? Well, and as soon as people were able to accept that, the whole branch of complex analysis was born, and we were able to engineer things that we never could engineer before. But we had to make that conceptual breakthrough about accepting something which seems pretty crazy to go forward, you know?
Well, I mean, in your own explorations too, you've had to make, I mean, I know I have as well, but, you know, going, you've kind of had to go out into the unknowns and, you know, stretch your mind far, even into the world of craziness a little bit, to kind of come back to the center, if you will, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think I have a quite a large capacity to review information that I don't necessarily agree with, and be able to tolerate that and take from it the partial truth that I find there, and to remember that, but not to just believe all of 100% of it, but just to have that capacity to, you know, look into different areas that seem really on the fringe maybe. But oftentimes there's a grain of truth in it. And then I have also this ability to match patterns where I, you know, I'll remember something from that I noticed quite a while ago, and then it, you know, a bell rings when it, you know, it correlates with something else, and I take note of those types of correlations.
Yeah. So I mean, can you talk a little bit about your own, like, creative process? Like, how do you go about finding these correlations? I mean, I know obviously you use synchronicity, you use play, you use creativity, but I mean, how do you gain inspiration?
It's a mysterious process, and it's guided by intuition. I'll just get a feeling or sense that I should measure the area of all the pages in the book, for example. Or I should, why don't I measure the distance from Cleopatra's needle, where it was to where it is? You know, it's just a very subtle sense I have, I guess, that there's something, there's some energy there that I should check out. There's something to it. And then I'll, you know, go forward and do the steps. And sometimes, you know, oftentimes there's nothing there. But once in a while, it's incredible. You know, I had the idea that I should figure out how fast, what is the speed of sound, you know? And so I looked up the equation, and it turns out it's the speed of sound in air varies with temperature. And so I thought, okay, it's close to 330 meters per second. That's cool. Because, you know, the 33 is kind of a key. But then I thought, okay, well, what temperature would it be if the speed of sound was 333.3 meters per second? When does that happen? Turns out that's 3.3 degrees C.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's like, why is that? And then in a similar vein, I looked at the Earth's equator, and you know how the Earth bulges at the equator.
Sure.
Everybody knows that, pretty much. Well, I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
Not everybody. I heard there was a recent study on gauging scientific knowledge, and something like a quarter of Americans didn't know that the Earth goes around the sun. That one was really shocking to me.
Wow.
But anyway, the Earth's equator bulges out, and it bulges by 0.33% greater than a perfect circle. And then that was kind of amazing. I thought, wow, 0.33%, that's the 33s again. Then I looked into the, you know, the Earth orbits in an ellipse, but the ellipse is very circular. It's just very slightly off of being a circle. And I calculated, how much is that? How much does that bulge? And that's 3.3%.
Yeah, there's a whole list of things that dealing with 33. That's really interesting. I just opened up your book, Taking Measure, Explorations in Number Architecture and Consciousness, and you just list a few here. There's, you know, the eagle on the Great Seal, United States, correlates with the Scottish Rite and having 33 feathers on one wing and 32 on the other. You know, Jesus was crucified at age 33. Human spinal column is 33 vertebrae. The volume of the sun is 33 orders of magnitude larger than a marble. So just a bunch of really interesting yeah. correlations to 33. When you were talking about the ellipse, I always find it interesting that, you know, Isaac Newton was the guy that created differential calculus to help us understand this. And, you know, this was a guy that was studied sacred geometry, studied Kabbalah. You know, he translated the Emerald Tablet of Hermes. And I always find it interesting that people want to dismiss these esoteric and mystical aspects of this guy who was very clearly a genius. And I guess my take on that is I think that we're missing out of how these guys gained their intelligence and how they, you know, like you were saying, that you did a lot of this stuff through intuition. I think by him studying all of these different subjects and having that intuition allowed him to make the discoveries that he has.
Exactly. That's where all, you know, all creative thought comes from, a mysterious place. If we knew where it came from, we would do it more. You know,
it's not like you can just grab your crystal ball and, you know, yeah, do your seance and, you know, exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of an ineffable process. Where do our thoughts even come from? You know, it ends up being a mystery of sorts. You know, and Isaac Newton was the first scientist to create a temperature scale, and he decided to make it go from 0 degrees to 33 degrees.
Yeah, exactly.
From freezing to boiling water. And also in Fahrenheit, there's a phase change between 32 and 33 degrees. And this mirrors the feathers on the wings of the Great Seal of the United States and the degrees in the Scottish Rite. You know?
So obviously, you know, not arbitrary. With Newton.
Seemingly not arbitrary. And then, you know, for every degree Fahrenheit, that's equal. A rise of 1 degree Fahrenheit is equivalent to a rise of 0.5555 degrees Celsius.
Oh, really? And that actually correlates to the, what was the Washington Monument, right? It's 555 feet tall, is that correct?
That's right. It's 555 and a half feet, or 6,666 inches.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
So the repetitive digits seem to be a key. They come up over and over again in my research. And I think they're kind of just a key. I think that I just looked up the other day bank addresses that are 333 or 3,333. And they're statistically much higher than, say, 332 or 334 or 3334. Or 3332. The repetitive digits are like 10 times, there's 10 times more banks at those addresses than just one off from that.
Yeah,
and
so this,
because there's something to it. You know, people just know it subconsciously.
Yeah. So this kind of gets back to what you were mentioning before about almost like the conspiratorial angle here, that this stuff couldn't all just be created by some secret society or some Illuminati or fraternal brotherhood or bloodline or something like that. That a lot of these things, when you say, hey, I'm measuring the distance between where Cleopatra's Needle was and where it is now, that it just happens to come about this. There really seems to be sort of this back and forth between that there is a group of architects, engineers, or a group of people kind of behind the scenes that do understand this information, and yet at the same time, I think that they might understand that this stuff just plays out naturally. It just naturally occurs in the world, correct?
Yeah, I think that there are such things as conspiracies, and there are people that are planning things in secret. But I think that's probably a lot less than people kind of popularly think these days.
Mm-hmm.
There's also all these amazing synchronicities and the numbers around, you know, the sun and the moon and the cosmos that can't be a Freemasonic conspiracy, you know? It's just impossible.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the Freemasons tuned into that knowledge and or it was passed down from ancient Egypt, essentially.
Sure.
Where they got hints of you know, pay attention to these repetitive threes. You know, that's really important.
Yeah, one number I kind of wanted to cover in this talk, too, speaking of, you know, these numbers being passed on and things like that, is the number 108. I just wondered if you wanted to talk about this a little bit, because this is a number that seems to come up again and again, obviously a divisor of certain numbers like 216 and 864 and whatnot. But
yeah, 108 is... it's one of the numbers in what I call the cosmic sequence. And, you know, it's in things such as 108 stitches on a baseball, or the top of the FM radio dial is 108 megahertz. You'll see it in a lot of mythology. The number 108 pops out. It's the element silver has an atomic weight of 108 grams per mole. And the moon has a radius of 1,080 miles. And so there's a resonance there between silver and the moon through the number of 108. But it's a member of this sequence of, it starts with 27, 54, 108, and each time you're doubling. So then it goes to 216, and then 432, 864, 1728, and then 3, 4, 5, 6. Which is also a straight of numbers because they're in sequence.
Sure.
And I think, as far as I know, that's as far as the sequence goes. I haven't found any resonances with higher numbers. But there's all kinds of I've written some lengthy blog posts on the cosmic sequence. And in my book, Quantification, there's an image here called, there's two on facing pages. One's called 864 Terrestrial. And the other one, 864 Celestial. And so I think I have a little bit more material on 864 as compared to 108. So if you don't mind, I'll tell you a few things about 864.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. I was just going to mention when we were talking earlier about the star octagram and the fact that, we have this symbol of the sun and it has 8 points. And of course, 8 times 108 would be 864, and that being a number of the sun. So just wanted to
That's
point
right.
that out. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, like Stonehenge is 86,400 feet from Silbury Hill. The Dome of the Rock is 864,000 feet from the Temple of Baalbek. Rosslyn Chapel is 864,000 meters from Saint Sulpice in Paris. That's sort of a Dan Brown thing. Both of those structures were in the Da Vinci Code. And the Transamerica Pyramid is 8,641 kilometers from One Canada Square. And these last two were discovered by Jan Tolstrup. And One Canada Square was originally designed to be 864 feet high. And the Transamerica Pyramid is 864 feet high if you include its mast. And so
So,
it's just amazing that these resonances exist.
yeah, so obviously you have a little bit of like, okay, was it, when you what was the measurement again to the transatlantic pyramid? The height of it is 864, which resonates to the sun, and then it's 864 or 8,641, you said, kilometers?
Yeah, but in different units, not feet, it's kilometers, right?
Exactly,
And I
yeah.
find that the number is the key. It's not the unit. But I found that the units all have, like kilometers and miles, have resonances with the Earth in different ways. Like they're the what is it? 10,000 times phi kilometers is the combined diameters of Earth and Moon. And I think it's like 99.98% accurate, very accurate.
Wow. Yeah, and that's something you cover in quantification, right? I think I just read that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The isn't it the kilometer times phi, isn't that equal to a mile or
Yeah,
something?
approximately.
Yeah, like it's very close, right? I mean, it's 1.61 or something like that, right?
It's pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're sort of loosely related by phi.
Yeah, and that's once again that's well, I like the fact that it's called a golden mean. The phi is called a golden mean, and mean is a balancing point, which means that everything is kind of balanced on this. So the fact that we find numbers very close to that seems like it's that there is an importance there. I mean, that's what I see anyway.
Definitely,
Yeah.
yeah.
Speaking of phi, actually, you have you have this awesome image that I think you took the picture of it. It's called the Phi of God. And it's where it's showing. It's just a triangle, and it's the triangle circumscribed, and that this encodes phi, and that you found this out. And I found this really interesting that inside of this triangle is the all-seeing eye of God. And I find that really interesting that basically just by simply circumscribing this triangle, you get this ratio of phi that seems to be so important. And I mean, Nassim Haramein has shown that this is. It's in galaxies and all the way down to the atom, and then obviously we see this all in, on the human body and in plant life and everything like that. So I find it really interesting that just by showing this triangle and circumscribing this triangle that we get phi, and it's almost like that, that symbol right there is almost an archetype of reality in and of itself. It's there to reveal and conceal. I mean, the information's right there. You just have to go in and measure it as you have. Found that pretty
That's right,
interesting.
yeah. And I took that picture of on a church in Venice, Italy, and it's a triangle inside a circle, and then there's a circle kind of interlaced within the triangle. And it turns out that the circle and the interlaced circle and the triangle have the same area. So in a way, this is like triangulating the circle.
Sure.
And phi comes right out of that. It's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. To me, it shows just a simple elegance to well, geometry and the architecture of our world in a way.
Yeah, the phi is one of the keys to understanding the universe. I'd say pi, phi, and e are all very, very important.
I would agree. Hence my show, right?
I seem to remember a couple of books you wrote about
Yeah,
pi.
yeah. Well, you know what? That's gonna wrap us up for pretty much this time. I'd love to have you back on the show in a few months or whatever. If you got some time, I'd be honored. I'm just a big fan of your work. You've inspired me, and I know you've inspired a lot of other people. Do you want to give people some info before we take off here?
Once again, you can check out my work at secretsinplainsight.com, or you can check out my professional work at scottonstott.com.
Cool. And so what's next for you? What else are you working on? You just released the book. Where is the book out now? Can people buy it right now on Amazon?
Yeah, people can get it at secretsinplainsight.com. I also just created some T-shirts that I have for sale that have Secrets in Plain Sight on them. And
nice, you got swag, dude.
New T-shirts every month.
Awesome, that's great.
That's kind of cool.
So cool. Yeah, I would highly recommend Taking Measure, your first book. Highly recommend Quantification. I really love everything you do. Check out Scott's blog on secretsinplainsight.com, and of course, check out Secrets in Plain Sight 1 and 2. So what are you working on next? What's next for Scott Onstott?
Oh, I've got so many projects going. It's hard to keep track, but I'm actually working on some AutoCAD stuff right now. But creatively, aside from that, I'm writing a novel, and that's going really well. I'm also developing a television series, and that looks very promising too. So. There's no end of creative work on the horizon.
Nice. Can you talk a little bit about your television series, your novel at all, or is that you got to keep the wraps on that for right now?
Yeah, I don't want to do that yet. Yeah, because they're kind of in process, so I don't want to spill the beans yet.
Okay. Well, maybe next time you come on, you can spill the beans.
All right. Sounds great.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on once again, and keep up the great work, Scott.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thanks once again for listening, everybody. Our outro song is provided by Elsa Va and is called Take What You Like. She hails from Sioux City, Iowa, and is just a fantastic singer-songwriter. The first time I heard this song, I'm not kidding, I must have listened to it on repeat about 100 times. It's just a very beautiful tune, so great work there, Elsa. You can reach her at ReverbNation.com, where you can stream all her music there. She's got a bunch of really great songs and is almost a mix between Mamie Mann and Joni Mitchell a bit, so very cool. If you are in the Midwest, you can book her for shows, and I believe all her information is available on ReverbNation.com, and that's ElsaVa, so check her out. Coming up on the next few episodes of the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, we'll be featuring music from bands such as The Fingers, The Family Business, Jamelia, Jane Joyce, and future guests will include Mayan scholar and author John Major Jenkins, Freemason and author of the book Written in Stone, Richard Cassero, sacred geometrician and rogue scholar Randall Carlson, and author and videographer Court Lindahl from Geomantic Information Systems. Be sure to stay tuned and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks. Thank you.
because you like him, just leave the others behind.
Been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com, and be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.